Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland, and it's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour, commentary from the ground up on the issues that matter most to you. I'm Patricia Kullberg, and I will be your host this morning. Today, we're going to take a look at the international movement to stop ecocide, which means literally the killing of one's own home, in this case, planet Earth. Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker talk about the International Criminal Court and efforts to criminalize ecocide. We'll follow that discussion with an interview by Norm Diamond of local union electrician Isis Harris about her efforts to promote the entry of people of color into the construction trades. Bill Resnick wraps up our show today by talking with lifelong radical union activist Wendy Thompson about her perspective on organizing within the Detroit auto industry. This is your volunteer-powered community radio station, KBOO, which is only on the air because of listeners like you. If you can, please go to kboo.fm and donate today to keep community radio alive in Portland. And thank you to all of our generous supporters who have given in the past. We're going to start our show today with our Left in the Law series by Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker. Last month, the International Criminal Court, or ICC, recognized their 20th anniversary by discussing ecocide as a possible fifth crime in its statutes. Jan and Mike take a look at the ICC and the International Stop Ecocide campaign, and in particular, the daunting challenge of using the court to prosecute fossil fuel companies for wanton destruction of the environment.
Well, Mike, these are boom times for big oil, even as the planet is burning. At the same time they are enjoying record profits, these companies face waves of environmental resistance around the globe, including in the rights of nature movement, the moral and legal principle guiding many indigenous-led actions, and the global campaign to stop ecocide. Last month, the Stop Ecocide campaign won an audience at the meetings of the International Criminal Court, or the ICC. On their 20th anniversary, members of the ICC discussed adding a fifth crime to their statutes, with ecocide the most promising candidate as threats to the environment reach critical tipping points. Well, let's start with this statute, what it means, and then how it might be used in global fights against oil companies and other extractive industries. So how is the ICC defining ecocide, and what's driving this campaign for a fifth crime?
The fact that right now there is no way that one can punish somebody directly for harm done to nature. And most all the crimes that are punishable have to do with hurting other people. And what the effort to make ecocide an international crime would do would be to try to make systematic damage on a large scale to the environment every bit as bad in terms of being able to be punishable by arrest and prison as shooting somebody. It's an interesting effort. It's pretty systematic. It hooks onto the International Court, which is a shaky body in many ways because they've done an excellent job of going up and down Africa and indicting African rulers and one or two Serbians, but have done absolutely nothing in the wake of systematic damage done by Europeans or United States citizens. But it is nonetheless a court. It is international. It has 123 member states now. The U.S. was a member, but then withdrew when it became possible that our conduct in Afghanistan could be brought into the dock. So what's happening is an effort to it's a recognition that existing treaties, agreements, and even civil lawsuits, which we've talked about before, have had essentially no effect. And it's hoping to criminalize conduct that is right now only subject to other forms of limitation that don't have any real bite.
Aren't there already laws that criminal laws against corporate irresponsibility or damage to the environment, or most of those civil cases?
It's all civil cases. Damage done to the environment is not a crime. You can cost somebody money, and then if you fail to pay, there may be some remote way by which you could be imprisoned. But basically, the only crimes have to do with assaulting people. Right now, for example, if Chevron in Ecuador lays waste to 1,000 acres of tropical forest, that in and of itself is not a crime. Now, people can, they can be sued. They have been sued, and they've been subject to multi-billion dollars of damages. But oil companies are making so much money now that civil suits really are like fleas. I mean, Exxon last quarter made over $1 billion every single week. They've got massive amounts of money, and they now are extending their exploration efforts because they know this is the last roundup. Right now, consumers of oil are desperately seeking alternatives. There have been lots of sort of slow greenwashing promises to do better in the future. But now that the cost of oil is so high, there are very serious efforts all over the world to replace aviation fuel, to replace ship fuel with hydrogen, to increase tremendously the use of solar and wind power. Solar power is now cheaper than almost any other form of power. There are massive amounts of power being extended. So, but because of the war in the Ukraine, there is a spike up that has the only good result for, I think, people who listen to Left and the Law is that Venezuela is in better shape now than it was. But basically, all the large oil companies are just swimming in money. Saudi Arabia has got trillions of dollars that they've profited from recently. As a result, there is going to be more environmental damage due to these extra exploration efforts being undertaken all over the world. It's an effort. I mean, we've talked about civil cases, but civil cases are winding their slow and stately way through the courts. And the Exxon and Chevron are just superbly set to delay everything, to spend a decade deciding whether the state or the federal government should decide the case. And the effort to criminalize this behavior is, it's a serious effort. It's gotten some support from 23 of the 123 states that have signed on to the International Court of Law.
The panel that reviewed the criteria and some of the obstacles to be confronted described the trade-offs around damage to the environment and the economic value of these activities. Can you speak to that, in that these extractive industries forever have said that we're the engine that makes the world go round. It powers economies and daily life. So it's not wanton destruction like you see on battlefields. How is that issue addressed through the formal criteria of the panel? Because that did seem to be a problem. These companies say we're producing a product that the world needs and wants.
They're vulnerable only when they just wantonly disregard the environment in which they work. I mean, it's true. All of us are going to be relying on steel and iron and oil all day long. These are products that enable society to function. But there are ways of gathering those products that essentially destroy the world. You can overreach so far. There is a way that's relatively responsible to extract iron, steel, and oil. And then there are ways of being completely indifferent. You know, iron mines, for example, leave tailings. There was a dam built in Brazil that was built badly. And as a result, the water necessary that had been held back by the dam, along with all the extra materials generated from iron mines, it washed down and killed people. That was, as we've learned later, the product of cheap decisions made by people who were mining that iron. And they are held liable because they're held liable because of what happened to people. There are hundreds of people who died as a result of that negligence. What Stop Ecocide Law would do would not be to ban any sort of extractive industries, but rather force them to take into account non-human values, to recognize that there are critical values in nature itself, that is, outside of human beings, that need to be respected as they go about their business.
This does then, in a sense, support the indigenous land rights movement and rights of nature movements around the world that are themselves have had some victories. In 2008, the indigenous land rights movement in Bolivia pushed through one of the most radical environmental bills in global history under the banner of protecting Mother Earth. And there are a number of similar laws. The Maoris won a precedent-setting legal case after years of organizing around the rights of nature, when the Crown government in New Zealand agreed to recognize mountains, national parks, water, and watersheds as living ancestors to whom humans bear the responsibility of care rather than as mere property. And here in the US, there's a campaign to win rights for the wild rice in the Midwest that is part of a creation story and First Foods for Anishinaabe people there. How much does this ICC campaign support those land rights or rights of nature campaigns?
Well, they are being picked up a lot by countries in the global south, like Kenya just last week at a UN Ocean Conference announced it'll be creating a creation of an offensive ecocide as part of an extensive package of environmental law reforms that'll include protection for environmental defenders in Kenya. There's now like 23 or 24 countries who've signed on to the notion of creating a separate crime in addition to genocide, something called ecocide. And I think it does have attraction in those parts of the world that are bearing the weight of extractive industries. The air pollution, water pollution, temperature changes are profoundly affecting not only places like Phoenix and California in this country, but are having even deeper effects in Bangladesh, in Africa.
Could you explain and walk us through a thought experiment of how that would happen? You're an executive with Chevron based in the Bay Area, and you're operating in Nigeria or someplace. And how would this affect your operations if there were charges against Chevron executives before the ICC?
Well, if ecocide becomes the fifth crime that's over which the ICC has jurisdiction, and if they are able, they issue an arrest warrant. And now the ICC has issued like some 37, 38 arrest warrants, and only eight of them have been fulfilled because they have no army, they have no ability on their own. No state would have signed had they had to relinquish power over their own citizens and not have their own police force. So they're dependent on police forces of the signatory countries. So assuming that this Chevron guy heads to Nigeria and there is already been an arrest warrant issued for him, then it's quite possible he could be arrested upon landing in Nigeria. But the Nigerians would really want to arrest him. It would be a voluntary thing on their part. I think the whole notion of an ecocide crime, for one, would have an effect on something called business confidence in a way that a civil suit wouldn't. If you are labeled as a criminal it might make it harder to finance what you want to do or get permissions from local governments for what you want to do. So, of course, the idea of imprisonment is a noble goal, but it's pretty far down the road. If you can get somebody, first get the crime created, which is the process that's undergoing right now, and then it's all defined as the wanton indifference to the natural world, a similar crime to the sort of indifference or deliberate and malicious attempt on a person, putting that over to the natural world. If you have so defiled a watershed, the wanton ways, that is, ways that have nothing to do with any legitimate activities, then you've committed a crime. Now, this crime now, they'll issue a warrant for your arrest, and that in and of itself will be widely publicized. And I think it would have a genuine effect on not only morale, but also the financial and general mobility of your business. But assuming that you do go to Nigeria and the Nigerians want to cooperate, they do arrest you, then they would ship you off to the Netherlands in The Hague, where all the trials in the International Criminal Court take place. And then you would be in the dock and you would be witnesses called. And it's not all that different from an American criminal court proceeding.
Well, it may be a cold day in hell before that happens, or a very hot day on the planet before that
happens.
That's
more like it.
But it's a wonderful thing to imagine. You're saying there are other important impacts, political and economic, that follow from this campaign to stop ecocide, including through the ICC. So we'll have to continue to follow it. It's worth following. It's a ray of hope in an otherwise dark horizon.
Well, it will extend the notion of Mother Earth beyond indigenous populations and make it part of the formal world that we know, the power structure that is shipping and creating and mining and is actually running the world, and to have the non-human world recognized as a full and essential part of the planet, like people, would be an advance. And of course, it would only really leap forward if there were truly a roasting hot day that kills thousands of people. That's the time when there's really a critical mass of damage, when you would criminalize the behavior that led to such a disaster.
Well, thanks, Mike. So we'll continue this, and it's certainly a moral campaign as well as a political and legal one. Take care. Stay cool.
You too.
Despite repeated warnings of dangers up ahead, captain won't be listening to what's been said. He feels that there's a good chance that we've been misled, and so the captain's planning.
The music you just heard was from Paul McCartney's tune, Despite Repeated Warnings. Before that, you heard Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker with their take on the ICC and the International Stop Ecocide Movement. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Isis Harris is a skilled union electrician working here in Portland. She's also an African-American woman and a distinct rarity in the construction trades. Norm Diamond talks with her about a family event on August 20, one of three that are planned to promote BIPOC entry into construction jobs. With all the talk about promoting diversity in construction and all the supposed initiatives, why are actual changes so slow in coming? The Community Pulse series is a community-based effort with fun activities and hands-on workshops to go beyond what the industry and unions have tried until now. Here's Norman Isis to tell you more about it.
This is Norm Diamond. I'm in virtual KBOO studio with Isis Harris this Monday morning. Good morning, Isis.
Good morning, Norm. How are you?
I am doing well. You look cheerful. I got to alert our listeners that any extraneous noise we hear is from a three-year-old in the background who doesn't quite yet appreciate that his mom is actually recording and going to be on the air. So other than that, the voices you hear will be those of Isis, who has recently obtained journeyman status as an electrician, as a union electrician. Becoming journeyman is both a high level of skill and a tremendous amount of perseverance. So let's start out. Tell us about that process.
Yes. So the apprenticeship program that I joined is through NECA IBEW Electrical Training Center. It's the Inside Wireman program, and it is a five-year program. So you have 8,000 hours on the job and about 2,000 hours of classroom time. And during the course of my apprenticeship, I started off in the low voltage program and then transferred over to the inside program. So that added a little time, but then I also have a three-year-old. So there was a maternity leave that was taken during the course of the program that also extended my training. So it was a long road, and perseverance is definitely the right word to use as far as what it took in order to complete.
And it seems to have paid off too. We were talking about the enhanced responsibility you have on a job.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a change that happens from apprentice to journeyman, where there's a different level of respect that you're given as an independent worker, as someone that's able to complete a job, and just, you know, the being seen as a more capable individual on the job site is very important, and it adds to the morale while doing the work.
Well, I've congratulated you personally, separately from this, but now let's put it out over the air. Congratulations. I think that's a great accomplishment.
Thank you very much.
I'm proud of you, and I suspect the three-year-old in the background, Dominant, is going to be proud of you too.
Thank you very much. Yeah, that's my hope.
Let's move to the topic of our conversation. More than 40 years ago, I used to have tea regularly on Thursday mornings with the head of the Columbia Pacific Building and Construction Trades. And one of our topics was diversity and the need to enhance diversity in the workforce, in all the construction unions. And by diversity, we were talking about racial diversity and gender diversity. Like I say, that's more than 40 years ago, been having that conversation. Outside of the construction unions, I've been aware of the same conversation in other unions as well. And of course, lawsuits even have been brought by people who felt that they've been excluded from union membership on grounds of their race, on grounds of their gender. You're right now, you're creating a project, or you're part of creating a project we're going to get to. But as a Black woman, what's your perspective then on this issue of diversity?
My take on the issue of diversity is that there's more needed in several different industries, but in construction, particularly, it does stand out as a need. There has been more gender diversity, I would say, since the beginning of my apprenticeship to now. I have seen more women on the job, but I haven't seen more racial diversity per se. A lot of times I am the only person of color on job sites or on my crew, or and the only Black woman that may be on a project. And that is something that, you know, it's pretty glaring that there is more racial diversity that's needed. So it definitely needs to be a more intentional recruitment process.
Why is it taking so long? I mean, again, there's been talk and talk and talk.
I think that's part of why it's taken so long, that there's been a lot of talk and not a lot of action behind the talk. I think that a lot of the talks happen at a very high level and not on basically the ground or grassroots level where it's actually affecting the workers themselves. A lot of initiatives are started by these coalitions of contractors or training programs or things of that nature, but it doesn't necessarily trickle down to what you see in the field itself.
Why not?
I think it's just the levels at which it happens. So the conversations are good, and the conversations may be rich about the diversity that's needed. There may be statistics and the information that is shared in those conversations, but when it comes to actionable items, I think that that's where there's a lack. There's not a lot of action behind the conversations. There are different programs that may be put in place that are supposed to enact those type of things on work sites, as far as making work sites safer, enforcing different rules as far as discrimination, things of that nature. But if you're not working on the intentional aspect of recruiting from more diverse communities, then everything that's happening at those high levels isn't as impactful as it should be.
I'm going to say it a little bit more strongly, and you can agree or disagree with what I say. Sometimes talk at whatever level can be a cover for non-action.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So if we want to get raw about it, Norm, we can do that too. So
this is your opportunity.
There is definitely that is a problem. I think that there is a lot of talk that sounds good, but just no real action behind it, and sometimes no intention of actually enforcing those different things. So I think that once it comes a point where something is put together that makes it easier for these people, these companies, these organizations, and just to get behind it and help to push it and not even build it, when that happens and they don't get behind it, I think it really shines a spotlight on the fact that they may not be really behind the words that they speak.
You and I have talked about the way in which Black folks, we've talked specifically Black men, are channeled into certain kinds of jobs, certain kinds of expectations about their lives. How much is that a factor too? And how do you see that actually?
I think that there's some limiting beliefs within the Black community, and there hasn't been a lot of action put into debunking myths on the potential to do different things. So I think, there's a lot of different things as far as like STEM and STEAM and things of that nature, so that the horizons are broadened for the opportunities for people of color to get into, and particularly the Black community. But I do think that there have been some limiting beliefs as far as how people can get out of impoverished situations within the Black community, as far as like playing ball and getting into sports. Like, those are the only options to live a good life, or those are the only options for Black men to have any type of economic empowerment. I think that the trades themselves, that historically that they have been, that they have excluded people of color, trade unions in particular, and that's you can look in a history book and see that. Now I do think there's a lot more talk about diversity efforts. I think that there's a lot more, there's action behind diversity within the trades, or at least initiatives in place, but there's still a lot of work to be done. And I think that one of those actionable items is actually getting the information out to the Black community, getting the information out to BIPOC communities about pathways into construction, into the trades, so that individuals have the information that they need to obtain these jobs, this middle class employment, so that they don't have to accrue a bunch of college debt thinking that that's the only way that they can actually have a good life and take care of their families.
You've been active now in creating some of those opportunities. This goes well beyond just talk at this point. What's your role been? And tell us what you've been creating.
So what I'm working on now is the Community Pulse series. And this is it's an event series, a three-part series that I created my company, Everyday Grind, is basically the platform that I used in order to create this series. And it's a series that is designed to connect the BIPOC community, the Black community, to pathways into construction. So by the way that the event is organized is that there will be pre-apprenticeship programs, apprenticeship programs, construction contractors, and construction adjacent businesses that all come to one place. And they're able to provide the information that they need, that the community needs in order to understand what the actionable steps are that they need to take in order to get into the construction industry. So it's an effort to encourage intentional recruitment from the Black and BIPOC communities. But I just want to say that I am very intentional about getting the information out to the Black community, because I feel like they are one of the more overlooked demographics as far as recruitment goes for the construction industry. So with that being said, these three events were put together. They will take part in three different areas in Portland, three different areas in Portland, so that everyone has action at getting the information that they need to basically put that information into play in their own lives. So the first event is going to happen on August 20th. It will happen at the field that is next door to the Salvation Army. It'll be an outdoor event, but there'll be some climate control measures in place as far as canopy tents and canopy tent fans to keep people comfortable while they're there. There'll be some hands-on workshops that are going to be facilitated by electrical workers for the wire light workshop, which is sponsored by the NECA IBEW Electrical Training Center. And then there will be building a birdhouse with the community, and that is the Pacific Northwest Carpenters Institute that will be facilitating that workshop.
You come there, you make a birdhouse, and you get to take it home is what I...
Yeah, so you build it there, you get to take it home and, you know, put it wherever you want in your yard. But also, I think it's just important for people to have that hands-on experience, for it to be interactive, for them to, you know, touch the tools and the some of the materials that they would be dealing with working in those different areas. The Northeast STEAM Coalition will also come out and do something with the youth. So for the younger kids, they'll come out and do a workshop. They're going to be building a solar-powered model that the kids can take home as well.
Nice. And I understand games and activities for kids. This is a family-friendly event.
Yes.
And got to mention, there's going to be food.
Yes. So there will be a kid zone that will have face painting and balloon animals, things of that nature, so that outside of the workshop, the kids have some entertainment as well. There'll be a DJ, you know, there'll be some music so that people aren't just kind of, you know, just existing at this event. But there will also be free food. There'll be a light breakfast that's served, as well as a lunch that comes free to the community or to the attendees at the actual event.
Tell us again, when and where?
On 8/20/22, it will happen at the field that is next door to the Salvation Army on Williams in Northeast Portland. It is at 5325 North Williams. That's where the Salvation Army is located. And the field is right next door. And the streets will be barred off, so you'll see some signage. If people come out, they'll see some signage that says, you know, event ahead, or, you know, road closed, things of that nature. So you'll see those things that will give you an indication that you are where you're supposed to be. So 8/20 is the first event. 9/24 is the second event. And October 15th is the third.
And what time? What time of day?
It will be 11 to 5.
Okay, listeners, you also get to meet Isis, who will be there, right?
Yes, yes. Please come out, have a conversation. Let's get into it.
Very good. Thank you, Isis. I'm going to wish you luck with the events. I hope we reach some people actually will show up. But it's also important for all of us to be aware of just the larger kinds of issues around diversity, yes, as well.
So, absolutely. Absolutely. Without the information, there's, you know, we can't really put it into action and have an impact on our lives or the lives of others. And that's what this is about, just getting the information out there so people can utilize it how they see best.
And talking with Isis Harris, this is Norm Diamond for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO.
Thank you.
Thanks, Isis.
Standing there, killing time. Can't commit to anything but a crime. Leaders on vacation. An open invitation. And I'm moving. the good girls go to hell. Cause even God herself has enemies, and once the water starts to rise.
You just heard a clip from a song entitled All Good Girls Go to Hell by Billie Eilish, who sings about the hills that are burning in California, and don't say I didn't warn you. Before that, Norm Diamond was talking with Isis Harris about the local community initiative to promote BIPOC entry into the construction trades. To find out more, you can go to the Eventbrite website and search for Community Pulse. You can also find a link to the event by searching for the Old Mole August 15 at KBOO.FM. Next up, Bill Resnick talks to Wendy Thompson, who after college took a job in the Detroit auto industry in the 1970s with the intention to help build radical caucuses within the United Auto Workers Union. Wendy reflects on how the challenges and opportunities to organize workers changed over the 30-plus years she was part of a radical movement within the UAW.
Hi, Wendy Thompson. Welcome to KBOO.
Hey, Bill. Appreciate it.
Wendy Thompson retired in 2005 after 33 years on the shop floor assembling axles for trucks and SUVs in the plant. It was called then Chevy Gear and Axle. It became, after GM sold it, it became American Axle. Wendy stayed on. She was then the union president. She was the first woman hired in the plant for the shop floor. And at the time, around 8,000 men. It became much less. She was a union militant. About halfway into her 33 years, she was elected to the shop floor chair, which is an important position in the plant, and in 1999, elected to president of her local. Of course, it was the United Auto Workers Union. We'll be discussing today's UAW and the push by UAWD, that is United Auto Workers for Democracy. It's a caucus that's struggling for democracy and much more in their plant, including environmental response to global warming. First, well, Wendy Thompson, tell us your story. How and why did you get a job assembling axles? What were your aims? And then we'll talk about why you stayed on.
Well, it really was the fact that I belonged to a political family growing up. My parents were active in the civil rights movement, and I became active myself at the age of 12. So I was very concerned about the question of racism. And then later on, I decided I was going to be a teacher. And I went to France because I was going to teach French, and I was junior year abroad, and I was there in 1968. And it was there, actually, where I came in contact for the first time with the labor movement. The unity between students and workers there was just amazing to me. I came back to the United States deciding that I wanted to be active to change things. I really had left because love it or leave it, I hated it. I was going to leave. But my friend said, no, go back to your country. That's where you'll have an impact. And so I took that seriously and decided that I would have more of an impact if I became an auto worker than if I became a teacher, which is ironic because teachers are playing a big role in the labor movement today. So I was living in Los Angeles, but I was in touch with other political people. They were all going to Detroit. Detroit was the epicenter because it was not the question of black leadership in the community that had the power, but black leadership in the working class. So you had a drum develop here in Detroit. They had a film they put out. I was just very excited by that.
Tell us what drum was, just for a second.
Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement is what it was called. And it was organized in the auto plants. And they put on a film about their organizing, what they were trying to do, and seemed very effective. You know, they could not kill off the black leadership if they were working in the plant like they could in the community, because then they might deal with strikes. That was the idea. So I picked up and went to Detroit specifically to become an auto worker. I grew up around Chicago, so I was moving back from Los Angeles to the Midwest where I grew up. And I really appreciated living in the Black community and working in a factory with a majority Black workforce. Yes, I was one of the first women, and that was exciting also to be making that change. But I know that's not your normal history, but I have no regrets of having made that decision way back when, under very different circumstances than what we have today, unfortunately. No movement like we had then.
Right. You wrote a short biography, it was published by a couple of journals of the left. You wrote that in the 1970s, capital was restabilizing, I guess making profits then, putting down worker rebellion, responding to the Japanese and German invasion, making profits. Quite a few radicals then left industrial work, but you and many others decided to stay. And I'm quoting you, you decided to be revolutionaries in a decidedly non-revolutionary period and prepare for a future upsurge. Looking back, what do you see as your frustrations and failures, but also your accomplishments? Seems to me it's a bit of half empty, a lot full. How do you see it?
Well, you know, when I got to the plant, I started to see myself as an organizer. And the consciousness of workers at that time was very much they felt that they could bring about change. They felt like they had a lot of power. So it was a positive environment that I was in terms of people who I felt wanted to struggle and fight back like I did. But then when the crisis came, the oil crisis, things did change. But you know what still remained was the class struggle. And that was what kept me active and busy. And I didn't feel like nothing was going on. There always seemed to be some fight that was going on every day when I went to work. And I never really thought about giving up on that, except for once, you know, having wanted to be a French teacher, I was thinking of moving to Quebec when the struggle was there. The union movement was so strong in the 1970s. But I remembered that it is, again, like my friends in France had said, it's in your own country that people are going to listen to you the most. And I found, even though I was white in a majority Black setting, that I did get listened to, and it was appreciated the fact that I wasn't racist like most white people in the plant were at that time. So I never really wanted to quit, and I always was happy that I stayed on. Another thing, too, though, is I got fired 3 times and got back to work each time with back pay. That does not happen very often. And as my fellow activists would say to me, boy, you are such a positive example. Don't give that up. I mean, you know, if I got back to work with all that and then quit, it would all be lost. So that was a motivation for me to stay. GM didn't want me, and I was going to hang in there and make sure that I stayed and gave them a whole lot of trouble, which I did.
This is Bill Resnick for KBOO Radio and the Old Mill Variety Hour, talking to Wendy Thompson, who worked 33 years making axles in Detroit. In her last 16 years, she served as a shop chair. That's an important position. We'll be hearing a little bit more about what she did in it. And then the union president. So, Wendy, these were not office jobs. You didn't sit around. I imagine you were near always on the shop floor. What were your tasks in those jobs? What did you do in those elected positions? I imagine was lots of arguments with foremen and their supervisors and the plant managers and maybe even some of the upper management. Tell us about that, what you were doing on a daily basis.
Yes, well, true. I did have a reputation of taking on the really disgusting supervisors in the plant. There were many of them, and they treated workers just terribly, and I would go to war with them, and I sort of had notches on my belt because I would drive them crazy. And one of the things was, of course, always being on the shop floor. Most union reps would hide out somewhere and you would never see them. But I was always there. And I encouraged people to write grievances, and not in just individual grievances, but group grievances. Every time it rained, it would come pouring through the roof, and I would go around and get everybody's signature on a health and safety grievance. So everything went into the grievance procedure. I distributed a newsletter on a monthly basis. The entire 33 years that I was there, didn't matter if I held a position or I didn't hold a position, I felt like talking about what was going on in the plant and what the key issues were was fundamental. And that newsletter was very important and pretty awful later on when I was a president and the shop chair was my enemy and he told management not to let me in the plant, that I stood by the plant gates and handed out the leaflets, and workers would say, oh, I see you more than I see my union rep. That's pretty awful that that would be the situation. So I tried to change a lot of things. We had a group working together in the early days. Later on, it was harder to get people to be active in a group, but I still would try to hold meetings at lunchtime and break time or right before work or right after work, and always would be listening to what the concerns of the people were on the shop floor and then trying to get them to organize around their concerns and fight back.
There must have been many wildcat strikes. It's often some part of the assembly line break down and the workers decided it was a real safety problem or whatever and demanded that it be fixed before they returned to the line. That happened very much. Was that you must have been right in the middle of every one of those little struggles.
Yes, 1973, we had three wildcat strikes, and I was involved in those. But it would be a thing, a thing of workers would come up to me and say, we're walking out at 10 o'clock. And I would go, okay. But I learned that if you hear that that's when people are going to be walking out, you do leave the line. I was working on the line at the time. But after you leave the line and go out to the aisle, turn around and look back and see whether everybody else has left the line or not. If everybody is still on the line and you walked, go get a drink of water and go back to work. Luckily, in my situation, everybody did leave. But we did have some people who were slow and we had to push them to go out the door. But we were lucky. Nobody got fired. This was in 73 when this was happening a lot. But later on, you know, there were not any wildcat strikes later on after the oil crisis and people became more hesitant. Wildcat strikes in my plant anyway did stop. But it was exciting when it was happening.
You represented your members. I gather all of those meetings that you had were also people discussed what was going on in the plant, what they could do, and a whole lot of people in your tenure were educated as to, in fact, the, quote, class struggle, and understanding that workers only made gains when they really struggled. And you were also a member of a number of rank-and-file groups, the New Directions Movement early in the 1990s. You participated in the auto caravan. We'll talk about that. You're now participating with UAWD, Unite All Workers for Democracy. You were always in struggle then, not just with the company men, down from the lowliest foreman to the plant manager and probably above, trying to get rid of you, and it was impossible. But also you were in struggle with the UAW bureaucracy that was very committed to keeping control. So give us a sense of that struggle and the capacity of the old guard to keep reproducing itself. New leaders, new men, but cut from the same cloth.
I mean, our idea of us who went into the auto plants was that the UAW was a progressive union because of the ideas Walter Reuther had developed in terms of unity between the community, getting involved in the civil rights struggle. But what we really underestimated was that he had built this caucus that was very highly centralized under his control. And he controlled it from the top of the union down to the bottom of the union. And that remained incredibly strong. And fighting against it was very, and to this day, still is, very difficult. But they, you know, with their control over everything, they jumped right into going along with management through what was called joint activity programs and saying that our interests are the same, the company and the union. And then they went along with just-in-time and lean production, management systems which are pervasive today, but were developing beginning in the 1980s. So this is where New Directions came in to fight back against this system of lean production and joint activity. And it was where they were able to elect one independent to the International Executive Board, and that made this enormous caucus hysterical because they want total control. They didn't want any independence. So I very much got involved in trying to build this movement, but they came down on us like a ton of bricks. And I was shop chair of the shop committee, which is the top position in the GM structure at that time. And the fact that I supported an independent and not the administration caucus in the elections, they came into my plan. I'm talking about international union and organized a local caucus against New Directions where they promised everybody an appointment. This is how they were able to keep their control. You didn't have to get elected anymore. You could have a permanent job that pays a lot more for the rest of your life. And this is still going on in the union today, and it is one of the things that has led to the corruption charges that have been so devastating on the UAW and are ongoing at this point in time.
You know, let me be a devil's advocate. The UAW bureaucracy, I think that, of course, they like their jobs and big salaries and trips to Bell Harbor with the AFL-CIO and playing golf down there in Florida and the rest of the stuff that goes on. But what they had was this sort of ideology that, yes, they thought that they should get big salaries because they were fighting with people who were making millions a year. And second, though, they thought that they were saving the jobs of their constituents, working people on the line. They had a tough job in some way that they didn't do very well. But the Japanese and Germans were building good cars, and GM and Ford and Chrysler had to catch up. They lost a huge amount of market share. And in fact, they considered the militants in the union like you to be creating an atmosphere of resistance to kinds of changes that they thought necessary if they're going to build a decent car and compete in the market and save American jobs. Well, of course, that wasn't true. The auto plants were moving out of the country, and that's another problem they had. They wanted to save jobs, so they made deals to keep the plants in the country and create, for example, a two-tiered system where new people were hired for whatever it was, somewhat above the minimum wage, but nothing like the people who had worked for a long period. How do you respond to that argument? I don't think it's accurate, but I'm being devil's advocate.
On the question of quality, you know, it's exactly the opposite. That is, on the shop floor, you can see that management did not care about quality whatsoever. Run it, you know. That was what they said. And so we, as the militants, tried to take up that issue and say quality should be a strikeable issue. So we felt like we were the ones talking about how to make better quality. And they were the ones, the company management, that was causing a situation where the quality was not good. But, you know, the other thing, too, as far as fighting back, is that the union went along with this idea of one plant getting played off against another so that the ones that would get the work would be the ones that would be willing to give the most concessions. But there's no end to that. It's just a funnel downwards. And instead of having it be where issues could not be negotiated on the local level because they wanted everybody to have the same standard nationally, they allowed more and more to be negotiated separately and allowed this situation where things just got worse and worse. As far as plant closings, they had no strategy to fight back against that because actually the strategy is a pretty big one. That is, anytime they threaten to close one plant, you have to threaten to strike all plants to keep that plant open. That's the idea. Don't give any no local to give a concession, or else they're going to have to deal with the union nationally. And then internationally, that should have been the same strategy. You know, work not going from one country to another because unions in those countries have united together and they all fight back. Why not Mexican workers and American workers going out on strike at the same time with a unified list of demands? So we were the ones trying to build international unionism and going down to Mexico and participating in labor conferences. But the leadership of the union was not doing that. So they just played into the company's hands. And then they, what did they care? They got great salaries, but they let workers' salaries go downhill. And so the difference between their salaries and our salaries became very, and still is, very great. Not good.
This is Bill Resnick for KBOO Radio and the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Wendy Thompson. Wendy, thanks a lot for talking to us today.
I want to see this world. I want to see it boil. I want to see this world. I want to see it boil. It's only 4 degrees. It's only 4 degrees. It's only 4 degrees. It's only 4 degrees.
That was music from a song by Anoni entitled 4 degrees, about how the world will look when the average global temperature is 4 degrees Fahrenheit higher. Before that, you heard part one of a two-part interview by Bill Resnick with lifelong radical labor activist Wendy Thompson. Part two, which will air in a couple of weeks, will address the response to accelerating global warming by the auto workers and other unions. That's it for our show this morning. Thanks to Moles Jan Hocken, Mike Snedeker, Norm Diamond, and Bill Resnick for their contributions, and John Nelson for his editing assistance. A special thanks to our guests, Isis Harris and Wendy Thompson. And we couldn't have done it without the steadfast support of the hardworking staff at KBOO. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been your host for the last hour. The show and each of its segments will be posted later today on the webpage at kboo.fm, along with links to related material. Catch us again next Monday morning at 9 a.m. for more views, reviews, and interviews from the ground up. I'm going to leave you this morning with one last song about climate change. This one is called Feels Like Summer, with lyrics by Donald Glover and sung by Childish Gambino. The song is not about the loveliness of summer weather, but rather how each day is getting hotter and hotter, and the hope that this world can change in time. Thanks for listening.
You can feel it in the streets on a day like this day. It feels like summer. I feel like summer. I feel like summer.